Thank you very much, Commissioner Phillips. Now, Lead Wagman has some research to share with us on the impact on investment from the in the EU as a result of GDPR. So I'll turn it over to you. Right about now. Yes.
Plus a couple extra seconds.
Okay.
Yeah.
Perfect. Thank you, Amanda.
Thank you for having me here. It's a wonderful panel to be on. And this is joint work with Ginger Jin at University of Maryland and Jian Jia at Illinois Institute of Technology. I've been working on data and privacy for nearing two decades now, and this is just an exciting area. I'm really happy to share some results with you. These are mostly empirical results. I'd like to bring up that we had some warning signs about GDPR. This was almost an experiment run in several Bay Area counties in the early 2000s. This is shortly after the Graham-Bliley Act was passed, and local counties could adopt stricter laws, and three out of those five counties adopted an opt-in ordinance, essentially, where your data could not be traded by financial firms. This is financial data. It's pretty sensitive data, unless consumers provided opt-in consent. And the other two counties, in this case Marin and San Francisco, adopted the opt-out approach, where your data could be traded unless you actively opted out of it being traded. The result was pretty stark. For a couple of years, we had this natural experiment before CalFIPA came in and superseded these local counties' ordinances. Essentially, the counties that adopted the opt-out approach naturally had more data collected about consumers, but there were less default on loans, and mortgage rates were more affordable. Yeah, so we see some of the benefits of having this opt-out approach. Now, as you all probably know, I'm just trying to get rid of this. Maybe Amanda can help me to get rid of this bottom thing. GDPR adopts essentially opt-in. It gives firms a choice between legitimate interest and opt-in, but most firms adopt opt-in. All right? So some other work theorized that GDPR is going to be harmful for ventures. One work said compliance costs are going to deter both innovation and bring some of it into established firms, into larger firms from new ventures. Another said compliance costs, say from GDPR, would disproportionately burden smaller ventures, those innovators, those job creators. And so that led to a hypothesis that new data restrictions are going to inhibit investment in new ventures, particularly technology ventures. And GDPR created an experiment for us. We can test if this, in fact, holds for those European ventures. So what we did is we looked at GDPR, exactly what approach it has. We see that consumers decide their access, their use, and how to manage their personal data. Firms must have either legitimate interest or opt-in consent to collect data, severe penalties per violation, and most firms in practice just adopt the opt-in consent approach because legitimate interest is just too hard to defend. Some large firms have simply resigned not to use data on European citizens. American firms have simply said we're not going to use data about them because we don't want to face the potential cost. I'm not talking about small firms. I'm talking about really large firms that I'm not going to name that have adopted this approach. We have Bloomberg saying that the 500 biggest corporations are on track to spend a total of $8 billion ahead of the enforcement date. So enforcement date being May 25, around that same date, we have major platforms releasing their own new policies. This is what we call in economics indirect effects or spillover effects. You have new policy, well, market players are going to react to it, and that's going to have some indirect effects. So what we did is we collected a bunch of data on venture deals. Those deals where investors come in and give money to ventures. Ventures are going to innovate a new product, come up with a new service. We looked at 5.5 years of this data, and we had over 100,000 deals just for the U.S. and the EU alone. But we collected data worldwide. The data included venture information, everything about the ventures, like name, location, category, founder date, and so forth. Anything about the deal and anything about the investor side. Pretty much a full picture of investors coming in, perhaps syndicating and investing in a venture. Yeah. Just to give you a few examples, we have ventures that are brand new, receiving their first seed round. We have ventures that are a little bit more mature and are receiving their Series A or Series B round. And we have ventures that could be 10 years old that are receiving a bunch of funds coming in to maybe go public. Those ventures are located all over the world. Just to give you some visual here, these are some summary statistics of the average number of deals per month in the U.S. and the EU. You can see there's many more deals in the U.S. You see that the median amount raised per deal is about twice in the U.S. compared to the EU, and that the firm age tends to be somewhat comparable. Okay, and the number of average investors per deal is also somewhat comparable. Most of the deals happen for these youngest firms, the 0 to 3 year old. But they obviously receive the least amount of money per deal. Right? They're just new. And if you look at the proportion of the data set that comprised those youngest firms, it's about 70% were between 0 and 6 year old. It's most of the data. And in terms of raw numbers, we're talking about tens of thousands of deals for those new firms, those innovators, those job creators. So if we look at this from the perspective of how old a firm is versus how much money it raises, you can see that most of those deals for the youngest firms occur in the seed stage. That's the very initial money to get the venture going. And as the firms get older, say 0 to 3 to 3 to 6, you can see those bubbles getting smaller because they're getting fewer deals, and they're getting higher because they're raising more per deal. As they get older, those bubbles get smaller and higher again, okay, because they have fewer deals and they raise more. All right. So again, much of the data is those youngest firms who are just trying to get off the ground. And most of the deals are concentrated in those blue states or member states in the EU. Now, looking at it by location is quite interesting because we can see the spillover effect on American investors who are considering investing in European ventures. For example, we can categorize deals into three. Domestic deals are within the same state or member state in the EU. They're in the same union if they're from different states, but in the same, you know, collective union, either the U.S. or the EU. And they're foreign if they're coming from across the pond. So, to give you a visual of how things look in terms of the number of deals, GDPR's enactment took place in 2016, April. Not much effect to that. But if you look closely, right around the time GDPR's enforcement kicked in May of 2018, you can see some divergence between the two trends, or the three trends if you look at worldwide data. So the dashed line is from the rest of the world, outside the U.S. and outside the EU. This is just in dollars invested. And you can see, again, there's something going on here. Okay, in terms of the EU, we can see there's some stagnation going on. All right. Now, this is just the raw data. Our empirical methodology is a difference-in-difference framework, just an empirical framework, where we have two events, the enactment of GDPR and its rollout. We have a bunch of controls, macroeconomic controls from unemployment to median income. We have bunch of fixed effects. We're trying to control for basically everything else that might be confounding the results. We categorize into healthcare, finance, because the U.S. has laws like GLB and HIPAA in those sectors, and other information technology. We also use a survey of firms about how strict they think data protection is in their countries in the EU. Okay, the data protection law in our country is interpreted and applied more rigorously than in other member states. And so we even control for perceptions of regulatory strictness. And we're looking for, put simply, the effect of GDPR on the number of venture deals in the EU. Okay. This is the effect, just summarized in one table, one row. After GDPR, it decreased roughly 35% compared to the U.S. deals. Compared to rest of the world deals, it's pretty similar. All right. We can break it down further. If we take the more conservative number, 26.1, we can break it down by healthcare, finance, information technology, you can see they're all pretty similar. Even healthcare and finance, where the U.S. has laws, GDPR is widely transformative. It's drying up venture capital. We can break it down by seed funding, those earliest deals, versus primary funding, those 3 to 6 year old firms raising deals. And the effects are strongest for those younger, just trying to get off the ground ventures. Yeah, you can see the number of deals for those ventures as opposed to looking at the funding stage. The picture is pretty similar. We can look at more data-related firms versus less data-related firms. They both incur decreases. We can look at business-to-business firms versus consumer-facing firms, and you can't really see it, but I'll tell you. It's about twice as much for consumer-facing firms, but business-to-business-facing firms still incur a decrease. So far, I've talked about the venture side, and we see ventures are incurring all these losses in terms of the funding coming in. But on the investor side, things are just as interesting. Investors might have higher costs of information acquisition, due diligence, and so forth, particularly if they don't live in the EU. So let's look at that. This is a number of deals that are financed by foreign investors in the EU and in the US, and you can see what happens after GDPR. Basically, the number of foreign investors who invest in the EU dries up. This is same union investors, still in effect. And this is domestic investors, still in effect. Right? So what is the differential effect on foreign investors? Well, that's what I looked at next. And the effect is about twice as much for U.S. investors pulling out compared to domestic investors pulling out in the EU. So U.S. investors are getting out of there. And when we factor in perceptions of regulatory strictness, the effects are even stronger. When we look at what happens to the distance between investors and ventures after GDPR, it shrinks by about 25%, meaning investors are getting closer and closer. They're becoming more and more domestic. When we look at what happens to the number of dollars invested by American investors in the EU after GDPR, it goes down by about 41%. This is another comparison between U.S. investors pulling out and investors outside the EU and outside the U.S. pulling out, and you can see it's pretty similar. So this is not isolated to U.S. investors pulling out. Everybody's pulling out. We can look again at more data-reliant ventures versus less data-reliant ventures. The effects are stronger for foreign investors pulling out for both of them. We can look at the youngest ventures. You can see the effects are quite strong there. More for foreign investors pulling out. We can look at the earliest funding stages. Again, the effects are strong. And then older firms don't incur this effect. So we're really just hurting the youngest of firms. And that's what GDPR did. We could focus on business-to-consumer firms. The decrease is huge. Business-to-business firms, there's still a decrease. All right? So the last thing I want to show you is a picture about repeat investors. This is kind of fresh off the shelf. Repeat investors have some private information about what a venture is facing in terms of compliance costs, right? They're current investors. They have that insight. They have that insider information. And so we looked at what happens to repeat investors, and the probability that a previous lead investor continues on as a lead investor in the EU after GDPR compared to in the US decreases by over 30%. So those with insider information are running away. If we look at the probability that the lead investor continues in any capacity, even just gives them another dollar in the next round, also decreases 14%. All right? And the distance also plays a factor. So if we look at the probability that a lead investor who's farther away participates in the next round in any capacity, even just gives them a dollar, decreases by over 20%. All right. And this is just showing that the distance shrinks even more if there's a new lead investor coming in by about 25%. So, this is all kind of a negative picture. And one silver lining that may be argued here is, we're going to improve the data security sector, the privacy sector. There's going to be innovation in this sector as a result of GDPR, right? Well, there is. So the trend for funding for the data and security sector does increase in the EU after GDPR. It does go up. It goes up in the US as well, though. The thing is, it's a tiny sliver of the overall market. So it really plays, you know, a minor role. It's really a very, very tiny silver lining. In terms of robustness, we tried to break these results in all kinds of ways. We ran numerous pretreatment tests to see if the effects appear before GDPR. They do not. We reduced the influence of outliers, those big deals. We controlled for seasonality. We removed the treatment months. We used different data sets. We looked around Brexit. Nothing broke the results. The results just kept holding. So just to conclude, I would say that data regulation has costs. Obviously, more study is needed here. The data is 1 year after GDPR, but the picture it paints is pretty stark. And in terms of the enactment of the law that happened in 2016, it had really a lesser effect. That could be for a variety of reasons. Okay, we see that those large platforms are not static players, and so they'll respond to a law, and that has its own indirect effects. And we see that GDPR is transformative across sectors, from healthcare to finance to information technology. And although data security does pick up a little bit after it, it's really a minor pickup compared to the big picture. Thank you.
Thanks. That's really, really interesting stuff. The one thing I was thinking about when I said that about the data security, it's kind of almost like a broken Windows result. I mean, I think that... Okay, so there's that little sliver of uptick on investment, but that's investment that may be being forced in the same way of like a broken Windows fallacy. I don't know, just something to think about. So everything's negative. So there's no that's what I'm trying to bring everyone down. Moving away, I want to from the empirical, we see what at least some evidence of what GDPR portends, at least for investment and economic growth potentially. I wanted to now look at the mechanisms by which GDPR-like or European-like privacy regulations could be important. And I think that probably the most direct mechanism that Commissioner Phillips mentioned this in his remarks is Privacy Shield, where companies agree to adhere to certain principles. So, Jim, I wanted to turn to you since it's clearly your bailiwick. To ask you to talk a little bit about the state of Privacy Shield and maybe dig in a little bit more on what the requirements are. I think sometimes there's some confusion. Is, you know, if you say you're adhering to Privacy Shield, do you have to adhere to GDPR? Like, how close are I know that there are Privacy Shield principles, and what does it really require of a firm that commits, a U.S. firm that commits to Privacy Shield?
Okay, so can everyone hear me? Let me just first extend my thanks both to Commissioner Phillips for his remarks and his kind introduction, and James to you. And I don't see Peter Davidson, but he was our general counsel at the Commerce Department for about 2 years and worked very closely together, and I appreciate his invitation to be here with you today as well. If I could just do some quick preliminary remarks to set the stage a bit and provide some context. As you heard, I'm with the International Trade Administration at the Commerce Department. ITA is one of six bureaus of commerce. In a nutshell, our mission is about helping to create the conditions for U.S. industry to innovate and compete around the world. And with this connectivity explosion that we're seeing and the accelerating digitization across all industries, an increasing focus of our mandate is on facilitating these cross-border data flows in a way that protects privacy and instills trust and confidence in the digital economy. Before I dive in to Privacy Shield directly, I would like to just, again, set a broader stage. I think dovetails well with Commissioner Phillips' comments. I think it goes to just how important Privacy Shield and other sort of bridges, for lack of a better word, are, given the current fragmentation we're seeing around the world. So, again, I'll try to be very brief. And I think, it dovetails very well with your opening remarks. But as many of you probably know, there are today 4 billion people online around the world, half the population. There are, by some estimates, 25 billion connected devices. And every day, we all generate something on the order of 2.5 quintillion bytes of data, which I had to look up. It's a figure followed by 18 zeros. Within 5 years, the projections are 6 billion people will be online. And by some estimates, we'll have a trillion connected devices, all generating, conservatively, 10 times as much data as we do right now. The cross-border flows of these data, again, as Noah touched on, are absolutely essential to commerce and trade in every sector of the economy. At the same time, of course, we have to worry about online privacy and data protection if we're going to have confidence in the digital economy. Right now, data flows contribute about 22% of global economic output. They're projected to increase global GDP by up to $11 trillion by 2025. So, again, I just want to reinforce what's already been said. These data flows are absolutely integral to our economy in every sense of the word. The challenge we are now facing internationally is that there is today no globally accepted standard or definition of privacy, of data privacy, and there is no comprehensive multilateral framework concerning or governing online privacy and data protection. We have best practices and principles from organizations like the OECD and G20. We have digital trade rules in agreements like the new USMCA and CPTPP. But the trend we are seeing, the trend I am seeing, and I think, Noah, we've been on some trips abroad as well that we're seeing, is that there is this proliferating number of new and divergent privacy laws at the national level around the world. And it really is creating a more fragmented landscape in a regulatory sense, and has the potential to balkanize, again, as Noah alluded to, the internet in a big way. At a very high level, you've got these three models. You've got China with their focus on security. You've got the EU, of course, which we all know focuses on privacy. And however imperfectly, the U.S. tries to balance the legitimate concerns in individual privacy on the one hand, data flows for businesses on the other. And there is, I think we can all acknowledge, legitimate interest on the part of government in terms of national security and law enforcement. And we do try to balance that. And again, I'm not sure we always get it 100% right, but there is a strong effort to try to get that balance done in the right way. So I'm going to focus, of course, on GDPR for a second before the lead into to Privacy Shield. Again, Noah, you preempted me in a lot of ways. The EU, as we've both seen, is very aggressively marketing GDPR as the quote-unquote global gold standard when it comes to privacy. And several countries have already looked to GDPR for inspiration in crafting their own data protection laws. But even among those who are borrowing very heavily from the regulation, you do see these very significant legal differences and their cultural differences and how they enforce these laws. You've got, for example, in Brazil with their new general data protection law. It was modeled on GDPR. It's comparable in terms of scope, applicability, and financial penalties. But there are some very key differences with respect to the definition of personal data, the legal basis for processing, and breach notification, among other things. India's draft data protection bill, too, is very similar to GDPR. I know it was inspired by GDPR. But it includes, among other things, some very onerous data localization provisions and has some very wide-ranging provisions for government access to data for law enforcement purposes. I think even the California Data Protection Law, Consumer Protection Act, differs from GDPR in a lot of different ways, particularly regarding its scope of application, collection limitations, and rules governing accountability. So given this current state of regulatory divergence, the practical reality is we really are not going to have a single standard on these issues anytime soon. Earlier in my career, I practiced law, focused a lot on FCPA. For those of you who are familiar with the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, it was a law we passed in the wake of Watergate, and it took the rest of the world and the OECD decades to catch up. I think there's probably going to be a similar dynamic when it comes to these these laws around data protection and online privacy. So again, in addition to the regulatory differences, you have these cleavages and disparities in terms of cultural traditions and norms around privacy, different levels of economic development. Some countries simply can't afford to implement a GDPR-like regime. I think you're also going to have to add in the accelerating pace of technological innovation. That's going to make it very hard for a lot of these laws to keep up. So one other thing I want to note on, which I think, again, dovetails well with Professor Wagman, the costs we're seeing now, because we interface with so many countries both here and abroad, the GDPR compliance costs alone have been enormous. Companies now have had to purchase and modify technology. They've had to hire new people, create new data handling policies. And I think I read one bit of information that said your average U.S. firm with about 500 employees has to spend somewhere between $1 million and $3 million to comply with GDPR. Other estimates say in the aggregate, the U.S. is spending about $150 billion just on GDPR compliance. So I think one other thing that might be worth mentioning, I met with some folks from some of the bigger newspapers. I'm sure folks are aware, over 1,000 U.S. newspapers basically did the math and said, given the penalties of GDPR and the compliance costs and the low margins, quite frankly, these days in the newspaper industry, it simply isn't worth it to make their service available in Europe. And so they have foregone the European market altogether, as have many other small and medium-sized enterprises. I don't think this is what the Commission and others in Europe intended, but the reality is they have reinforced the dominant market position of the big multinational tech players from the United States. So with this growing number of unaligned regulatory requirements around the world, you're going to see other countries with their own versions of GDPR. It's only going to ramp up these multi-billion dollar compliance costs, not just for our countries, or companies, excuse me, but for companies from a variety of nations around the world. And every dollar we're now spending on complying with these unaligned laws is a dollar you're not spending on research, on innovation, on hiring new people, and expanding to new markets. So failing to address this cannot be an option. We have to address this fragmentation. And how do we do so in a way that protects online privacy and facilitates the free flow of data? So that was probably more long-winded than I expected it to be. But the only way we see right now, given the fact that there is no global standard, is to build these bridges. And I think we have two very successful examples of these bridging mechanisms. In the Asia-Pacific, we have the APEC cross-border privacy rule system, and then with Europe, of course, Privacy Shield. Privacy Shield, like Safe Harbor before it, for those who may not be as familiar, it's a certification mechanism. It enabled the United States and the EU to find a path forward after Safe Harbor was invalidated, despite our very different legal approaches to privacy. Basically enables companies to make public, legally enforceable promises to comply with Privacy Shield's data protection requirements, which generally align with EU norms. And how they process and hold information of EU individuals. We are now over 3 years into the Privacy Shield program. It was implemented in July of 2016, and it has consistently operated as a quote-unquote adequate data transfer mechanism, and that's due in large part to the ongoing dialogue between officials in the interagency in the United States, but also across the European Union at the EU level, but also at the member state level. We have had three very successful and positive annual reviews so far, and today we have over 5,000 companies that participate in the program, and I think one thing we need to do a much better job of marketing is these, again, are not just big multinational tech companies. Over 75% of Privacy Shield participants are small and medium-sized enterprises from across virtually every sector of the economy. And one of the reasons it's so appealing for SMEs is because it's cost effective. I think, and I'll look to Nick, I don't know if I get this wrong, you gotta yell at me. I think the cost for an SME is somewhere on the order of $300 or $350, and the highest is maybe a couple of $1,000s for a company like Google or Facebook, some of these bigger players. So it's incredibly cost effective. Both the administration and the commission have been absolutely unequivocal in their support that the program has been a success. Each year before our annual review, the White House has issued a statement saying U.S. commitment cannot be stronger to the framework. And I know Commissioner Jourová, the European Commissioner for Justice, who not only negotiated the framework with the United States back in 2016, but has attended all three annual reviews, has characterized Privacy Shield repeatedly as an unqualified success. Now, all of that having been said, folks here know Privacy Shield does face some legal challenges in Europe, most notably right now the so-called Schrems II case. And Schrems II focuses on whether EU-approved standard contractual clauses provide protections that meet EU legal requirements for personal data, considering the potential for the United States government to access data. Key questions are basically whether a European data subject has access to effective judicial redress under standard contractual clauses. This sort of begs the question, why is a case about standard contractual clauses implicating Privacy Shield? And the reasons, there's basically three. For those who are a little more familiar with Privacy Shield, it contains a new mechanism, a very unprecedented mechanism called the ombudsperson. That ombudsperson, the Privacy Shield ombudsperson, is actually not specific to Privacy Shield. It is available for EU individuals to raise issues or complaints to the United States government that they have concerns that their information may be accessed inappropriately by the United States government in some fashion. That ombudsperson mechanism, again, is not specific to Privacy Shield. It is available to EU individuals for data transferred under any mechanism, any EU-approved mechanism, whether standard contractual clauses, Privacy Shield, or any future mechanism that may be negotiated. So a second reason has to do with the fact that the Privacy Shield framework, which is rather unusual in my experience, it's actually primarily a series of letters, cabinet-level letters, it sets forth all the safeguards and protections that we have now since Snowden in terms of safeguarding individuals with regard to government access to their data. And every year at our annual review, we provide an assessment, and we get grilled by the European Commission about how these safeguards and laws are operating, and we provide additional information in terms of updates to these laws so that they have up-to-date information on what those protections are. Again, incredibly unprecedented. I don't know of any other country that does this. And then the third reason, the Irish court was pretty explicit in linking Privacy Shield to the Schrems case by basically asking whether if you take the Privacy Shield ombudsperson mechanism together in concert with the U.S. regime and the protections we already have in place, does that effectively provide effective redress that's roughly equivalent to what you expect in Europe? So that's sort of how Privacy Shield got looped into the standard contractual clause challenge. I was rather surprised, as I think many were, that it was the focus of the hearing in July to the extent that it was. But obviously, the case has a lot of implications. I know standard contractual clauses, I believe, account now for 90% of data transfers out of Europe globally. So there's a lot at stake there if standard contractual clauses were to be invalidated as a mechanism. I have my doubts, personally, that the ECJ would actually do that. But it also obviously could have a lot of dramatic impacts for Privacy Shield and transatlantic data transfers for SMEs. It could also impact another case in the pipeline, La Quadrature du Net, which is a direct challenge to Privacy Shield. So we are watching all of these cases very, very closely. And the United States and the European Commission are arm in arm in terms of defending the framework. And we have elicited the support of a lot of member states on these issues. So as is the case, or as is the norm, I should say, in most European Court of Justice cases, the Advocate General will issue an opinion prior to the ECJ's final ruling. I think that was originally due to come out the 12th, and I saw something yesterday that says it's been pushed back to the 19th. So we hope to get a preview of what the ruling may be in that case. I personally, and for what it's worth, I'm very confident that Privacy Shield works. I know Secretary Ross, my boss, shares that view. I think it would be incredibly impractical for the ECJ to invalidate Privacy Shield as a whole. Particularly, again, since this is primarily a vehicle for SMEs, especially, quite frankly, because, you know, as much as Europeans like to think that they are the gold standard with GDPR when it comes to privacy, what we have done in the United States government since 2015 with the Snowden revelations effectively make us the gold standard when it comes to protections against government access to data. And I do think if you'll permit me, there is a bit of a double standard with the European Commission, presuming in its adequacy approach to go around the world to evaluate everyone else's regimes, while they don't even have the power to evaluate their own member states on these issues. Let me see what else. I think you also made the point, which is also a bit difficult to take sometimes, and this came up at the annual review. There have, as far as I know, been zero enforcement actions brought against certain other countries. And I was in a meeting some months ago in Brussels, and it was interesting to hear someone at the table basically say, the Europeans are rather like the policeman who likes to just patrol the area under the lighted lamppost while ignoring the rest of the dark. I think that resonated well with a lot of people in the room. In any event, I do think, notwithstanding these challenges, which, again, we're watching closely, and I think we'll be in good shape for any contingency. It's hard to know exactly how it will play out. We have been engaging a lot more with the member states. For those of you who sort of know the dynamics over there, the Commission is the one pushing hard for the adequacy approach. The member state officials are the ones who actually have to implement GDPR and deal with these edicts from Brussels. And with the exception, I think, of the Commonwealth countries like the UK and Ireland, most countries are having a very hard time. They're under-resourced. They're trying to get more guidance out there because there's a lot of confusion. I think one bright spot is Article 42, I think it is, in GDPR, allows for the development of codes of conduct and certification mechanisms. And I think there had been an effort some years ago to say, could we take the mechanism that we have in APEC, which was multi-stakeholder with all the APEC nations in developing this framework, could we make it interoperable and sort of reciprocate, recognize the CBPR approach or some hybrid thereof to create a more interoperable bridge, if you were, to bridge the differences in our systems. Because, again, I'm sure most folks know this, all of these major privacy laws and frameworks and transfer mechanisms largely mirror the same principles that came out of the OECD guidelines and the FIPS before that. So there's not a lot of divergence in terms of the goals we're trying to achieve. It's just how we get there. So I think with, the EDPB, the European Data Protection Board, is just really beginning this process of looking at certification mechanisms and codes of conduct. I do think there's a great opportunity there for us to work together to build more of these bridges and overcome this growing fragmentation that we're seeing globally, which, again, I think is years, if not decades, away. So one thing we are trying to impress increasingly on our friends in Europe, and I think the data you shared was particularly helpful, is that digital innovation is continuing quickly. And we should be working together to bridge our regulatory differences so we don't miss this next wave of innovation. I think our collective advancement in science and industry, our respect for data privacy and protection, because, again, we do share largely the same values with our friends in Europe. I think our obligations, or at least my obligation and others up here who are in public service to our citizens and to others, all really require us to solve this common challenge. And I think the best we can do is build on these proven mechanisms to bridge these differences, to make sure the data does continue to flow and that we can avail ourselves of all the benefits, because these issues are not going to go away, and if anything, they're going to continue to proliferate. So we are pressing very hard to make sure the Privacy Shield succeeds. And again, my goal would be to make sure that we can make them interoperable and build these bridges around the world. So I'm going to stop there, but thank you again for the invitation to be here.
Thanks, Jim.